But as I discovered, though you can travel far and wide, you can't escape from the smell. If one has to love humanity, then in India one also has to learn how to love, and live with halitosis. I left Bombay on the 10th of October, 1964. In the 10 days that I had spent trying to do business in Calcutta and Bombay, I had achieved precisely nothing. That was, I suppose, the reason for my pessimism, but I looked forward to the long rail journey, for it would give me the opportunity to see a great deal of this enormous country. The British, I understood, had handed over the railways in fair nick to the Indian authorities. However, what with one thing and another, maintenance had not been quite so good since independence as it had been before. Accidents do occur a little more frequently, and the people who travel look upon them as an occupational hazard. Some extremely nervous, or cautious, travelers take all steps possible to make sure that as far as possible everything is in order. But they are the exception and not the rule. Never is the national characteristic of fatalism more evident in India than when traveling by train. Judge my surprise, then, when I noticed my traveling companion make a careful check of everything in the compartment. It was this eccentricity that made me notice him. The man was obviously a Sahib left over from the British occupation. He was very well dressed, and had the unmistakable stamp of authority in his bearing, but he himself checked the door handle and lock, the windows, and tested the seals as though he was of a very nervous disposition and quite unaccustomed to making a long railway journey. When he had tested everything to his satisfaction, my companion took the seat opposite me. Courteously, he inclined his head in greeting. Just as courteously, I acknowledged the greeting, at the same time offering him a drink from my bottle. This he accepted. I watched him closely as he savored the scotch, and he drained the flask top into which I had poured the drink. "Forgive me," I began, "but by the way you inspected all the fitments of the compartment, I take it you are somewhat nervous of traveling by train?" My companion smiled. "Not at all, sir. I am merely curious." He waved his hand to indicate the various notices with which the compartment was liberally besprinkled. I must admit that the man had a point. I have traveled on most of the major railway routes of the world, and on several of the minor ones as well. If I'd been asked, I'd have said that the limit of mistrust is shown by some of the Latin American railways, which exhibit prominently in the compartments such shattering notices as, "Do not accept food, drink or tobacco from strangers, they may be doped." As I say, I would have said that these notices were the ultimate of man's distrust for man until I read the notices that my companion indicated on the Bombay Madras Mail. "Beware of thieves." One notice exhorted me. Another told me to "beware of thieves asking permission to sleep on the floor of this carriage." Yet a third notice begged me to "please secure safety catches, latches, and barrel bolts fitted to the doors and windows, particularly at night. We seem," I remarked jocularly, "to be traveling among thieves. An honest man would seem to be a rarity in India." I had said this as a joke, but my companion frowned slightly as if I had said something very unpleasant indeed. So I tried to retrieve my gaff by offering him another drink of whiskey. He accepted, and cordial relations were once more established. I had intended to travel third class so that I might have the opportunity of studying the different types of native Indians, but at the last moment I had shied from this, the smell no doubt being responsible, and I had taken a ticket in a four-berth compartment. My companion and I were the only two traveling in this compartment, and after the introductory drinks we settled ourselves down on opposite corner seats and watched the Indian landscape pass by. I was so absorbed in what I saw that I entirely forgot about my traveling companion. I took it that he was equally interested, for he never interrupted by so much as a word. The Bombay Madras Mail had left in the early afternoon. After I had watched the environs of Bombay disappear into the distance, I began to think about sleeping arrangements for the night. Faintly amused, I read the warning notices once more, and then turned my attention to the four bunks with which the compartment was furnished. I have already mentioned that my companion and I occupied lower seats, that, by night, served as very comfortable berths. I inspected the mattress and found it to be first class. I wasn't so sure about the blankets, which seemed rather fluffy, and therefore, I thought, might be itchy. My companion, seeing me thus occupied, carried out a similar inspection of the other berth. He appeared satisfied, settled himself once more in his corner, and then leant forward and spoke in a confidential whisper to me. The nearness of the man gave me the opportunity to study him at even closer quarters than I had already done without appearing to be rude. I was aware, as I had not been aware before, of the extraordinary quality of his eyes. Any amount of clichés have been written about eyes. I could not have designed more expressive eyes than those my traveling companion had. On such occasions as these, one must turn to clichés, for, however hackneyed they may be, they do underline a basic truth. And in very truth, my companion had eyes that really talked. His eyes were not the only impressive feature about the man. I have already spoken of his general air of authority, an air that he maintained even when relaxing in his seat. I guessed his height at a little under 6 foot, 5 foot 10 or 11, perhaps. His height was accentuated by his slim build, and by his extremely long legs, which he kept tucked underneath his berth. But what fascinated me as much as his eyes were his unusually long, slender fingers. On second thoughts, it wasn't so much the fingers that fascinated me as the fingertips. He wore some kind of protection over them, unlike any form of glove that I had ever seen. But that is the only way to describe the style of the protective covering, fingertip gloves. For the rest, he was off-white in color, light brown, I suppose you would call it, a very light brown indeed. Even his hair was light brown. I doubt if he weighed 100 pounds fully dressed, but for all his slim build he did not give the appearance of being physically weak. Indeed, on the contrary. Something else arrested my attention. I could not help observing that every time he inhaled, so he contracted his hands. Indeed, it seemed that he had to have recourse to deep inhalation with every breath, rather as though he suffered from respiratory trouble. Not that there was any external evidence of this, for, as I have said, he looked a very healthy specimen indeed. I suppose my close scrutiny of him must have made my companion slightly uneasy, although he was courtesy itself when he addressed me. It was then that I received one further shock, for his voice did not appear to come from his mouth, but rather from a little speaking device that he had clipped to his chest. As we entered into conversation, I noticed a peculiarity about his speech. Although, as I have already mentioned, his English was impeccable, and he spoke fluently enough, yet there was always a slight but definite hesitation before he spoke. It was as if he was making the mental effort to say the first word, after which all the others would come spontaneously. But that first word was labored. It was a trick of speech that was not at all unpleasant. Indeed, I found myself waiting for it in much the same way as a man whose lover has the slightest of impediments in her speech waits for the unrolled door as the key signal of their oneness. His voice was nothing remarkable. There was a certain basic musical quality about it, nothing that betokened the great orator. Indeed, I suppose that the very cadence of his voice gave a certain quality of monotony to it. Yet all the time he was speaking, so he was smiling a warm, friendly smile. He introduced himself as Saturar. Obviously, Saturar was a man of great charm. Soon, my first reactions of surprise were replaced by those of warmth and friendship as we got deeper and deeper into our conversation. And while we were talking, the train ferreted deeper and deeper in the heart of Mother India. About 100 miles out of Bombay, the train passes through the last of the tunnels that pierce the highlands, which, until the coming of modern engineering skills, had proved an almost impassable barrier. It was soon after passing through this tunnel that Saturar asked me one or two personal questions. "You are not English," he remarked. "I was led to believe you were." "I am sorry," I said, "I had no intention to mislead you." "No, I am not English, but I speak several languages, and the best way to communicate in India is by using English." I looked at my watch as the express train to Madras, hissing like a dry cleaner's steam press, came to a stop in a large station. It was just on 8 and I looked out of the window to see if I could find the name of the station, but we were some way from any name board. Full night was almost upon us. The sky, despite the light rain that was falling, tended to be an orange-yellow in color, orange-yellow the color of ripening corn. But only the great Lord Shiva would know how many people in India would be left without food that night. On the station platform, hundreds of the thinnest, hungriest looking, bare-shanked fellows milled around. The lucky minority would eat a few tortilla patties, which wrinkled old ladies, squatting before charcoal braziers, were cooking. Some of the crones were sitting cooking right in front of the station master's office. They did not take any notice of anybody, but concentrated on their homely cooking, blowing into the charcoal embers in order to get the maximum heat. Everywhere, hustling, barefooted porters bustled about carrying the most unbelievable bundles, consisting of ragged bags, boxes, and other items of luggage. These they piled onto their backs and heads as if they were piling rubbish onto a garbage truck. To add to the din, infants were yelling, passengers were complaining in the loudest possible voices. Suspicious travelers and would-be passengers furtively eyed their companions. Perhaps these notices were necessary after all. Amidst this hullabaloo, I saw the poorest, most wretched woman I had ever seen in my entire life. She held a fretful baby in one hand, and held out the other for a tip. There she stood, a ragged, bedraggled daughter of Mother India, with a hungry child crying for food. This, I reflected, was the true face of India. Her Arabian Nights' splendors were a figment of the imagination. Mark Twain's sparkling jewels were spurious gems. Here was the stark reality of India, an emaciated, ragged woman. A crying, fretful hungry child. There they stood on that unknown platform, a gross, obscene monument to India and hunger. As I watched this woman and her child, a Brahmin pushed roughly past her. I could see the look of utter disdain on the man's face as he pushed her to one side. I could observe the look of disdain turn to one of horror as he realized that he had touched this untouchable woman. Without a word, Satara left the compartment. Through the darkening window, I could see him moving through the crowds. I rose from my berth anxious to find out what he was up to. A magazine seller wheeled his trolley up to my companion. Satara waved him away. The man was only interested in the woman and her baby. You did not have to be a doctor to see that the mite was dying, probably of malnutrition and neglect. A handsome, bearded European stopped at the little drama unfolding on that platform. He looked with compassion on the woman and the child. Compassion turned to astonishment as he saw Satara press a coin into the woman's hand and a tablet into the baby's mouth. I, too, was astonished at what I had seen. I was still more astounded when Satara returned to the compartment and without a word of explanation beckoned to me. "Please come with me," he said softly, "there is much to be done." I did not think of arguing, much less of disobeying. Instead, I left my comfortable berth, and followed Satara onto the platform. He led the way to the last of the coaches, a third-class one that was swarming with passengers. He clambered aboard, and I scrambled after him. When I found myself among the hordes of people inside the railway coach, I was glad that I had changed my mind and had decided to travel first class. As I looked around me, I was cross that there could be such extremes of poverty in a country that had its full quota of really rich men. More, why was the poverty anywhere on earth? I could not answer that question. Perhaps a trained economist or some other expert could come up with a satisfactory answer. I just knew that I could not, nor ever would be able to. The poorest of the poor travel like so many head of cattle in the third-class wagons of the Indian railways. Perhaps all third-class passengers are not so abjectly poor as that wretched woman and her child. But at a cursory glance it seemed that all the women and children in that coach suffered from some degree of poverty and deprivation. After I'd had more experience of travelling in India, I appreciated that fake ears, baroos, sheikhs and chapati-eating rascals also travel third class. They did not look hungry. It was always the women and children who looked hungry. This fact reminded me of the streets of Callao, which I knew so well. There, all the dogs are sleek and fat, it is the bitches that die of hunger in the gutters. The poor, hungry bitches of South America. By now, the train had restarted on its way to Madras. Belching smoke puffed its way into the tropical night. And as the train edged towards Madras, Satara and I ignored our comfortable berths, and picked our way through the miserable heap of humanity sweating it out in that third-class wagon which I had so nearly joined. Dim lights made the scene appear more frightening and distressing. The atmosphere was mephitic. We jogged to the tune of the train, and inched our way towards a group of young children, Satara had noticed wedged in one corner of this cattle truck of a carriage. When we finally reached these children, I was amazed to hear Satara speak to them in faultless Hindi. Again, he had recourse to the speaking device. I only had a few words of Hindi that I had picked up on my infrequent visits to India, so I was unable to follow precisely what he was saying. But I noticed that they all took the tablets which he handed to them. These third-class carriages are cluttered with the luggage of the passengers. Satara observed an old man squatting on the floor dwarfed by loaded baskets. Just to look at this old man, with his skinny arms outstretched in supplication for the inevitable tip, reminded me of my childhood days when I learned the stories of the New Testament. I hadn't thought very much about the New Testament since those far-off school days, but as Satara moved towards that sick, skinny mendicant, I was reminded of those stories. Particularly when Satara smiled at the old man and spoke what were obviously comforting words. So Jesus Christ, I thought, must have smiled and spoken as he went about healing the sick and comforting the weary. Satara gave the old man one of the tablets, and waited until he had swallowed it. Then we went round looking for others who were sick and weary. We found many of these, most of them looking as if they were ready for the last rites. Satara gave each of them a tablet from his seemingly inexhaustible supply. In our searchings, we repassed the first old man to whom Satara had given one of the tablets. Imagine my astonishment when I saw the old man get to his feet. I looked again more closely to make sure it was the same man. Elderly, skinny Indians look very similar. There was no doubt about it. Here was the same old man, but he was scarcely recognizable as the same person who had swallowed the tablet. There was even a faint smile on his wrinkled face as he held out his hands towards Samra. He wasn't begging this time. He merely wanted to touch Satura's clothing. My companion carried on with his task of healing. There was precious little I could do. I had no miracle drug. That was how I thought of the tablets, a miracle drug. So I did the next best thing. Pressed a few coins into the hands of the people to whom Satara ministered, and smiled at them, lacking any Hindi words of comfort in my meek vocabulary. When Satara had seen to all the people who needed attention, we took the opportunity of another stop to make our way back to our own compartment. I felt somewhat exhausted, and flopped down in my corner, searching for that bottle of scotch. Satara sat opposite me, still smiling, and apparently tireless. Just before the train pulled out, a venerable Sikh gentleman hurled himself into our compartment amid a flurry of a luxuriant beard and loose, billowing white clothing. He stayed with us for the remainder of the journey to Madras. Never have I had such a silent traveling companion as this bearded Sikh. At first, he sat next to Satara, who smiled at him. The Sikh looked stonily ahead. For mile after mile the man just sat there, his white turban hardly moving as he stared at a spot on the side of the carriage, a yard or so past my right shoulder. He was, I thought, probably reflecting on the wisdom of the British in putting up those warning notices. Satara and I spoke earnestly about the abject poverty we had witnessed. After about half an hour, we saw the Sikh clamber up to the berth above mine. He unfolded one of his nondescript packages. It turned out to be a kind of sleeping bag, which he fixed between the two upper berths, and then climbed into it as if it had been a hammock. Perhaps he had found bugs in the upper berth, although this was very unlikely. Although the Sikh had climbed into the hammock, he did not really go to sleep. It was one of the strangest sights I have ever seen, an example of sleeping with one eye open. And the open eye kept Satara and myself in focus, rather as if the owner of the eye thought we were a couple of those thieves against whom the British had warned the travelling public. The Sikhs' sleeping habits were so extraordinary that I took out my watch and made a time study. For 3 minutes precisely, the man kept his left eye open and his right eye shut. Then he would change over for another 3 minutes, opening his right eye and shutting the left. He must have timed his eye movements by the huge wristwatch that he wore strapped to the left wrist. And so it went on, in 3 minute intervals, presumably throughout the entire night. For when I woke up in the morning, he was still sleeping 3 minutes with the left eye, then 3 minutes with the right. During all the time he had been in the compartment, the man did not utter one single word. When he left us at Madras, he still had that worried look about him, as though he feared for the safety of his watch and the dozen packages which he clutched fiercely. We watched him go. "What an extraordinary character," I remarked. But then, I added as an afterthought, "I've seen many extraordinary things during this train journey." Satara smiled. "Are you alluding to me?" he asked casually. "No, not really," I answered, somewhat confused. "I am slightly annoyed with myself, though, because I can place you."
"Place me? What do you mean?
Who you are? Where you come from? What you do?"
"I see.
There's no real mystery about me, my friend. I come from Kotisoti."
"Kotisoti," I repeated,
"I've never heard of that. Where is it?
In Central America?"
"No, no, my friend. It is on Itabiratu, Itabiratu." "Now I know you re joking.
I assure you I am not. I've traveled the world," said, "extensively. I know my way about. And I've never heard of such a place.
Whereabouts is it?" I followed the line of his fingers. He was pointing towards the east in the general direction of the sun, which, even at this early hour of the morning, was already blazing from a cloudless tropical sky. Chapter 2, Strangers on Earth. I don't think I shall ever be able fully to analyze my feeling when Satara pointed vaguely out to space. Certainly, he had said it in such a way that I had no reason to think that he was pulling my leg. But before I could collect my scattered wits, my erstwhile traveling companion had bid me a courteous goodbye, had hailed a taxi, and had left me gawping in the station concourse. I was brought back to my senses by a taxi driver who pulled up alongside me and asked if I wanted to be taken anywhere. Automatically, I gave the name of the hotel to which I had wired a reservation from Bombay. Still somewhat dazed, I helped the driver load my luggage, climbed into the back, and pondered over the implications of Satara's casual words. What he inferred, of course, was that he came from another world, from another planet away out there in distant space. If my own personal philosophy had to be spelt out, I suppose I would have to call myself a pragmatical materialist. All my life I had dealt with concrete things, concrete facts. These were the things that I understood, that I could grapple with, mentally and physically. Anything beyond that, and I would be the first to admit that I was getting out of my depth. Yet undoubtedly I had spent the last 24 hours in the company of a flesh and blood person, albeit one with many remarkable attributes, who on our parting coolly informed me that he came from somewhere out in space. My mind just could not encompass the magnitude of what he had said. I mulled over the events of that train ride from Bombay to Madras, thought of the uncanny aptitude he had for languages, the miracle drug that he had dispensed to the sick and needy, the air of complete authority and self-assurance with which he had moved among the milling throngs of people, and found myself out of my depth once more. The taxi screeched to a halt. The driver opened the door and then started to unload my luggage. Still in a dream, I paid him off, signed the hotel register, went to my room, and pulled out that bottle of scotch. I don't want to give the impression that I am a soak. Far from it, although I keep on referring to that bottle of scotch, now, alas, three parts empty. I like my drink,
but I've traveled the tropics long enough to know that the hard stuff can be a killer, and I am wise enough to know the right time of the day when to relax with a drink. So I broke the habit of a lifetime, and had a stiff morning peg neat. Even the drink and the subsequent shower did little to clear my brain. No. That's not strictly accurate. My mind was crystal clear. I was thinking rationally, behaving normally, except, of course, in that one area of my recent experience with the man who called himself Satura. Still puzzled, I went down in search of some reference books. The hotel had a writing room in which there were several bookcases crammed with books in several languages. I went over to the shelves, made a suitable choice, sat down at a writing table, and very carefully and methodically went through an atlas that I had selected. I was unable to find any entry dealing with either Kotasili or Itibiratu. This did not surprise me greatly, as I've already explained. I've traveled the world extensively, and found myself in some very out-of-the-way locations. But I'd never come across either of the place names that Satura had mentioned. I'd be prepared to swear to that. Whilst I was pondering over the strange names, a sudden telephone call from the reception desk urged me to go downstairs, where a distinguished-looking Indian was pointed out to me by one of the bellboys. The man offered me the typical Brahmin greeting and handed me an art pamphlet with an address in Madras, religious, fine, Indian art, he whispered, and then he added the name of Satura. Again the polite greeting, and the man left without a word. I returned to my room on the third floor and pondered over this new implication. What people? Perhaps they want to sell me some religious art pictures? Or had I met with the head of some obscure religious sect, in which India abounded, and that airy wave of Mr. Satura's hand towards the eastern sun implied a mystical union with whatever god they worshipped, rather than an indication that this funny-looking man had come to India from the vastness of outer space? The more I thought about it, the more I found the whole idea ridiculous. But what was I to lose? After an excellent lunch, I took the same taxi, shiny now, because the driver had washed it, to the address indicated on the pamphlet. As this was my first visit to Madras, I watched with interest as the taxi took me to a section of the town that seemed to be dominated by vast mansions and palaces. My taxi decanted me at one of these palatial mansions. That meant, of course, that I had to give the taxi driver a bigger tip than I otherwise would have done. I did not immediately go up the front entrance, which I could see at the end of an imposing driveway. Instead, I stood back and admired the sweeping facade of the building. Most visitors to the tropics are suitably impressed by the many large mansions which they see dotted around the landscape. Most of these mansions are set in beautiful grounds, resplendent with a multitude of exotic plants and flowers. The mansions invariably have huge dining rooms with high ceilings, and the most elegant reception rooms. It would appear that, in the tropics, the poorer the poor, the richer the rich become. The riches, however, are not always of a permanent nature. Wealth sometimes evaporates for various reasons, so that a once wealthy family could well be left in possession of one of these superb mansions set in a spacious park, and yet not have the money for its upkeep. Few people have the money, or the inclination, to invest in such white elephants. The upshot is that many of these colonial mansions and palaces are turned into clubs. This, I imagined, was the case with Satura. He was staying at a club housed in one of these former private dwellings. That would be the size of it. I knew that Satura enjoyed a cultured way of life. In such a club, he would be sure of getting what he was evidently accustomed to. For this type of club usually had an excellent standard of cuisine and accommodation, often a tribute to the tastes of a previous owner. From my own limited experience of Indian hotels and guest houses, I knew that visitors of the highest social standard, the greatest wealth, spoke eulogistically of the variety, quality and appeal of this type of club accommodation. It is something of a paradox that while millions are starving in the vast subcontinent of India, these clubs will provide a menu running into 16 different courses for one meal. A person, were he so disposed, could work through all 16 courses at one sitting. I use the word sitting advisedly, for a diner rarely gets up from the table for at least 3 hours after sitting down at it.